Last time in Foundations in Social Innovation, we learnt about the intent behind Family by Family. We learnt about how the model was designed with families to be the kind of help that families themselves found helpful. And we heard how the model was prototypes with families.
It's just really starting from the bottom up, and I really, really understand now, and I think it's taken me the full 12 months, but I do really understand the potential that exists when you design and you create something with your end user versus creating something for them that you think will fit them best.
And we left Family by Family just as the model itself was operationalized for the first time as a real service with real service delivery dollars. Meanwhile, in a village 4 hours drive south of Hanoi in Vietnam, we learned how villagers had discovered positive deviant strategies in very, very poor families who nonetheless had well-nourished children. We left the Sternins just as they had invented a way to spread those positive deviant strategies between families through a regular convening where the children ate and families were expected to co-contribute shrimps and rice. Meanwhile, our band of intrepid travellers continue their journey to find their new homeland, improvising their way to the peak that they could start to see emerging in the distance. Will Family by Family find the formula for scale? Will the travellers find their new homeland? Will NASA get to the moon and back again? Join us in this episode of Foundations in Social Innovation to find out. This podcast is recorded on Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future, and indeed to all of the traditional owners of the lands on which you're listening today. Having found their way out of the fog and across the ravine, the climbers climbed and climbed until in the morning they could see the summit striking against the blue sky. This is what they had dreamed of reaching. And now that the summit was in sight, they realized that this was just the lowest peak in the range that stretched out as far as the eye could see. This was just the beginning. So I think in any social innovation work, there's a strong and logical case that what you really want to do is maximize the outcomes that your innovations create. If you're interested in outcomes, why wouldn't you share or spread or scale what works? And the second half of the innovation journey is what we're going to be covering in this episode. We left our stories partway up the slopes of invention. They developed a formula to spread change, but they didn't yet. They developed a formula to create change, but they didn't yet have a way to spread that beyond one site or location. That's the invention work that still had to come. The Family by Family team and the Sternins both had to invent ways to deliver change locally and to prove that those models worked. But then they'd need to go on to spread their models to other families living in other towns and villages, allowing for necessary adaption whilst protecting what's core to the innovation and what works in creating change in the model. Thank you. So to my great surprise, about a year after starting the family project, we were able to get funding to run Family by Family as a service in South Australia. Carolyn Curtis took over as director of Family by Family and set about building a team of practitioners and families. So far, we'd invented and refined the change model. But now the work really had to start. There were still heaps to be developed to support the model so it could be operationalised. This included all of the legal infrastructure for what people perceived to be a very risky program, the way to operationalise the measurement system at scale and evaluation, the way sharing families would be financially rewarded for their time and wisdom, and the way that new staff would be recruited and trained.
Because, I mean, you know, we did so much work in that prototyping phase, everything must have been done and dusted, right? You just picked up the blueprint.
In the original prototyping, I think we had very much focused on really designing and testing the interactions. But what we didn't really think about was everything that then needed to bring that to life. So, you know, what... getting really detailed about the broader roles besides that of the coach. We hadn't thought about a lot of the processes and systems and policies, and we hadn't really thought about designing a lot of the operational components that can have, and actually what we see in a lot of programs and in not-for-profits, have a huge bearing on then how interactions play out or how programs play out. So there was a lot of having to sort of go back and think about almost a lot of the in-between spaces, if that makes sense. But I mean, to this day, I mean, the core interactions, the premise of them, the design of them have remained the same. But I think in essence, that was almost the easy part. And I think that's what we're seeing in the not-for-profit sector now. It's more how you create the conditions around those. It's more how you create the right operational structures around those so they can do what they need to do.
That's a lot of stuff, but it still wasn't it. The invention would need to continue for many years. There were new elements to be designed. Some identified shortcomings in the original design, and some were about supercharging elements in the original design. They included the role of the kids coach to support children in the program and developing a custom curriculum for the children who are part of the sharing families. It included developing an Aboriginal community connector and coach role to shape the program to better connect with Aboriginal families. And it included a better way to collect measurement data, case notes, and manage the paperwork associated with the program through a custom designed app.
So we'd put a lot of thought into the coach role. But we hadn't really thought through articulating and designing and testing some of the other roles around it. So the kids coach, we hadn't thought about, or we hadn't sort of intentionally designed the person that would sort of play almost that head coach role, that practice lead that stitches everything together. And we hadn't really thought about, I guess, the administrative side and both that role, but then the design of what that role needed to do. And I think it was further compounded by the fact that TACSI wasn't set up as a service delivery organisation. So a lot of not-for-profits would have had a lot of those processes, procedures in place where we didn't. So we had to create them from scratch. So right through to from thinking about policies for home visiting through to mandated notification, through to health and safety. You know, we had to really think about also the actual, not the model in terms of the interactions, but the operating model. So how many, like one ops lead or practice lead could work with this many coaches, could work with this many sharing families and this many seeking families. And that sort of operating model design has a huge impact on the sort of quality and the growth trajectory of something like Family by Family. And we really weren't able to, that wasn't prototyped. in the early days for obvious reasons, but that's what we had to get to. The last thing I'd add is something where we really fell short in those original prototypes around interactions was with working with Aboriginal families. And I think, again, that's where the rubber hit the road in Playford, where we learned that even some of that original thinking around interactions needed to be adapted for Aboriginal contexts. And Playford gave us that opportunity to start thinking about that. And that's how Aunty Vicky came to us.
So maybe let's start with that. So you joined Family by Family.
Yeah, on the back of the report that Jess had created, I can never remember what it's called. I've got it here somewhere.
Yeah, it's called, it was known as the Frank Report, because it's actually where I got the name for my son.
Oh, okay.
But it was Aboriginal, creating change with Aboriginal families, I reckon.
Yeah. So there you go. I learned something new about you today, Chris, because I never knew that Frank was named after the report. Anyway, it was from the report. There was a gap, and that part, I guess one of the recommendations from that gap was about employing an Aboriginal person to be the conduit or the community connector, which is what we were called, which was what I was called in the end, to be able to open doors, I guess, and get access to Aboriginal members in the community.
What was it like coming into Family by Family at that time?
It was okay. I'd had some interactions with Taxi before because I've known Dan we were trying to work it out the other day when we were doing some cultural training, and I reckon it'll be coming up 15, 20 years. Wow. So I'd already known Taxi, and I was like, oh, this place looks amazing. And I kept thinking of Google at the time, because that's what it reminded me of. Whenever you looked at anything on Google, there was all these, it was bright and colourful and all these wonderful things happening. And, you know, that was at a time when we had that very long carpet runner in the hall, which was all different colours. And, you know, it was, and, you know, you'd walk in and Seb would be riding his little scooter up and down all over the place. And you'd say, you know, and when you walk into the rooms, it was like, it wasn't, you know, there were beanbags and lounges, and it was like just different way of doing, yeah, I guess, because yeah. I'd worked for government most of my life, and it was very white and very structured, and, you know, and so like walking into a Taxi was just, yeah, mind blowing, I guess. Funny. I still think it is now, even today, even though we like it, it's a little, it doesn't look as right, I still love walking into work when I go in there. So. Sorry.
Yeah, do you think we're getting too sober as we age? More conservative?
Yeah, I think. you know, I don't know. We still have, you know, we have yarning mats now instead of bean bags, I guess. So, you know.
That's better. That's a step up, right?
Change. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, Google hasn't got those. So what did you need to work out? In this, you kind of started in this new role. I imagine that there's still lots that needed to be worked out about that role.
That's true. Very true. So it was sort of like freelance, do whatever you need to do. And I didn't know what I had to do. All I knew from the funding aspect, all I knew is that we had to engage however many, and I can't even remember the numbers now. I don't think it was a lot, but it was 6 seeking families and maybe 3 sharing families or 2 sharing families. And I didn't even understand at that time what seeking and sharing was and what the program meant. And literally I, you know, was coming into this new organisation that to me wasn't the same as going to any other government organisation when you look in that really structured way of doing. I was coming into this new organisation, which was not-for-profit, and, you know, we're trying to do human-centred design, which I didn't even have a clue about what that was. So trying to learn the taxi side of it, as well as learn what my role in Family by Family was. So I was, and I always say this, I was really lucky that I got paired with Barb.
Yeah.
And when I first came in, because Barb and I started, she started a little bit before me, not by much, by about a month, I think. And, you know, Barb had a way better understanding of what Family by Family meant. But, you know, I was there to engage Aboriginal people. That's what my focus was, I guess. And I, you know, I remember I started on the Monday, and on the Tuesday we went out to John Street in Salisbury, and I kept saying to Barb, I don't know anyone out north, like, you know, I kept saying I don't know anyone. I don't know why. I just felt like I didn't know people. And we did a recruitment. And, you know, and a recruitment literally is just setting up a table and, you know, trying to chat to families. So we set out up outside the library at John Street in Salisbury there, and they said to me, right, and no one sort of called me Auntie Vicky at that time, or, you know, I was just Vicky. Right, Vicky, how do you... you know, how do you engage Aboriginal families? And I was like, and I was like, wait a minute. And I ran up back to the car, and it was lucky because at that time, I think we just had, was either NAIDOC week or Reconciliation week, and I had some flags, not these sort of flags, but, you know, paper flags in the boot of the car. And I grabbed the flag, came back and said, oh, and we found a lump of blue tack, and I stuck the flag in the blue tack. And the first three people who came up were Aboriginal families who saw the flag and said, oh, we saw the flag, but also I knew them. They come up and went, Honey Vicky, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, my goodness, I haven't seen you forever. I didn't know you lived out this way. And, you know, so I think what that proved in that, you know, and I didn't even know how to sell Family by Family at that point, because it was my second day in at this point. But what Barb did was she did the talking and said, I just brought them in, and Barb said, I can talk to them about that. And then, of course, I found my own way of being able to speak to Aboriginal families. So my spiel, I guess you would call it, was different to just done in a different, relaxed way compared to how we'd normally rattle off stuff, I guess. Yeah. And Bob's like, oh, and you reckon you didn't know anywhere? And I was like, I'm just really surprised that, you know, the first families. I said, but it just goes to prove that that Aboriginal flag is an identifier, and actually, you know, makes Aboriginal people go, actually, that's for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
what else did you need to change in the program to make it work more effectively for?
Yeah. So then as we went along, we, you know, I looked at the flyers that we used to have, and they were very non-Aboriginal, very white is the language I would use it, you know, and I was like, how can we change that? And so having Aboriginal people included in the flyers, the way words were written, you know, we didn't call it link-ups, we called it, I can't remember now, oh, it feels like so long ago. Anyway, we just changed different ways, the language on the flyers. And then when we, so Barbara, it's funny, Barbara always says that, you know, she she always found the doors and I was the key to the locks. So she found the Aboriginal doors and I was the key. So I was the one that got everyone through the doors, which, you know, we work so well together and still do to this day. It's very similar to that. So whenever we went out and talked about family by family, and we did it together as Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal cohesion, I guess, when we talk about the length of the program being 10 to 30 weeks or whatever, that there were extra steps put in there because relationship building may take longer, and when you're doing with Aboriginal families and so that, I guess, we change some of the process of what that is.
Yeah.
And then just me being me, I just like being the educator as always. I, you know, probably put a lot more education around the coaches, Aboriginal history education, you know, as well as through the families themselves. So the sharing families, making sure that there's culturally competent, or that there were competencies that were met, because a lot of families don't know, you know, histories, and, you know, and that's another thing altogether, I guess. So I did a lot of yarning and training and talking to families.
So I think there was an assumption at the outset that Aboriginal families would only want to link up with Aboriginal families.
Yeah, so in community, it's interesting because the Aboriginal community itself is actually not big, and the Grapevine is quite, you know, it's better than Optus or Telstra or whoever you want to call it these days. People, we don't want other people knowing your business and or seeing that, you know, you're going through hard times and, you know, and so a lot of times Aboriginal families like to be connected to non-Aboriginal families only because they know they won't go back to community and say anything.
Yeah.
I remember I was travelling from down south one time and there was a death in the family and, you know, and I was like, oh, and by the time I got back out north, you know, I literally just found out, and then there were me and people ringing me and stopping me in the street saying, I'm sorry to hear about blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, my God, I've literally only just found out. And you mob are all like saying, so that's how fast it travels like wildfire in community, some communications. I think that was probably one of the biggest things that we learned was, the Aboriginal people prefer to be with non-Aboriginal people for the fact that they know that they're not going to even accidentally talk about something, and it'll go, oh, well, you know, that person's not very good because they can't, you know, cope. You don't want people knowing your business either. You don't want people knowing, you might have a gambling addiction or alcohol and drug addiction, or, you know, and you're trying to do good for you, for yourself, and, you know.
But the really big step was how to get it so that other organisations could take up the model. And there are a number of parts of that. Some of them were developing a localization process or a scoping process that enabled us to adapt the model for a new context. Developing evaluations to learn what's working and not, as well as to build the evidence base for the program. Exploring alternative business models, distilling and simplifying the model to a set of principles and interactions, and developing a learning platform to support people implementing the model in other organizations.
And one of the things that you
had to do was to set Family by Family up in a new location in Playford, in the northern mm-hmm. suburbs of Adelaide. Could you say a little bit about what that involved?
Yeah, so that's when the rubber really hit the road. Like, obviously, we used that as an opportunity to design a scoping process and approach. So how we would go about adapting the model from one location to another. And that was really useful and valuable.
The second Family by Family site was just 45 minutes drive from the first, also in Adelaide, in the same relatively small city. And at that point, I really questioned why we needed a scoping process. But we ran one. And through that process, we found out that if we'd run Family by Family in the north to the same design as the south, it would have failed. The language used by families in these two areas of Adelaide was different. The methods used to recruit families in the streets needed to change. And the large gathering of families that worked to provide coaching in the south, because it was denser and people lived closer together, didn't work as well in a much less dense area with very poor public transport in the north that was also intersected by an impossible to cross road. So we moved to a distributed small group coaching model. And that was the model we subsequently adopted in the south because we realized that it created better outcomes for less effort and less cost.
And then, of course, the other key thing that had to really be thought through, which we're only kind of really breaking through now, but I think ideally we would have gotten to this much, 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 much sooner, was really thinking about how you maintain the quality and the kind of rigor and intentionality of something like Family by Family. Getting to that sooner would have made life a lot easier in hindsight. I think it would have also enabled us to be much clearer about, look, what are the absolute fundamentals of this model that we think are core to its outcomes and what are the nice to haves. It was really our first experience of trying to slot Family by Family in to an existing system and structure. So, you know, negotiating contracts, and it was between three parties. We had to negotiate with Anglicare, who were the holder of the federal sort of communities budget at the time. And we conceptualized things like, you know, KPIs and outputs very differently to how they did. So it was really our first experience of trying to insert Family by Family into an existing system, which was very challenging and still remains challenging. And I think the other thing we came up against a lot in those early days, and I think, you know, we've got much better at talking about now, is people would look at the unit price and go, oh, but I can get like 10 playgroups for that. Or, you know, I remember one of the things we were compared to was a cooking class down south. And so it became really clear that we had to get much better at telling the story of Family by Family and what it did and why, having a much better storytelling around that, but also the evidence was critical. And I think, you know, we did a lot to invest in evidence in the early days. I think that, you know, we potentially lingered around the developmental space exclusively a bit too long. I think, you know, to make to kind of really sell the proposition, particularly to government, we probably needed to look at some a bit more hard data earlier. All very good learning. And we still always evaluated Family by Family 10 times more than any other program was evaluated in the service system.
Hi. I'm Vita Mayrano. I'm the Director of Scaling Social Innovations at TAXI.
Vita is currently leading the scale of Family by Family in Australia and overseas. And I chatted to her about some of the invention that's had to happen in these last few years of Family by Family.
So Vita, let's talk about the evaluations, the many evaluations. How many are there of Family by Family?
There's four that I reference. There's actually a total of five.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I remember the very first evaluation. I was a little bit involved with that, this sort of realist evaluation that sort of told us some really useful stuff on the model when it was first running as a service. And it told us about what was working for whom, who it wasn't working for, and sort of really helped us refine the design of the model, I guess.
Yeah.
Since then, we've run lots of different kinds of evaluation, and you're in the middle of something quite exciting now. So it'd be good to hear about sort of what some of those different kinds of evaluation have been.
Okay. So after the 2012 one, we did one in 2015-16. It spanned 12 months, mainly because we're doing still a realist evaluation in two sites to compare the sites to see if they were being replicated with the same level of fidelity or not, as well as then contracted the Australian Centre for Child Protection, and actually they were doing a quasi-experimental data tracking using child protection data of the families that came through in that 12-month period across both sites. So what we did was track of the 106 families that were interviewed in that 12-month period, 42 had child protection notifications. We could access that. We had discussions with them, and we found actually at 6 and 12 months after that, after exiting a family by family, 40 families actually managed to keep their child protection notifications lower than on entry, and never after 6 or 12 months on exit got to the same level. So for them, they were saying, well, that's really about demonstrating that whilst child protection data point is a blunt tool, there could well be evidence of a promising program here from a gold class evidence kind of building case. What we found and what we understood of those two families that didn't, we actually learnt a lot about the failing bit as well, right? So whilst all the data was anonymised, we did know that those families had bigger number of children, and what that meant is we could understand actually those two families were two families that joined family by family, and we didn't realise that they were actually going, they were on, basically they were going to be separated. They were going, there was an order that the social workers were implementing in the background, and we didn't know.
Yeah.
So within 6 weeks, the children were removed. So we were never going to have efficacy on that program because the children weren't there. But what it did help us understand is how do we shift practice to help practitioners ask some of those questions of the system to make sure we're focusing on investing the time and resources we have with the families who can get the best outcome so they're ready for change. Because that's, you know, those families that are so close to being separated and have removals, there's very little opportunity for that change to happen. What we also learned from those three evaluations then is we redistilled our theory of change. So in the developmental process of delivering programs, you know, you design something, we're testing why it works, what are the different elements of it, and what are the outcomes. So over the course of those four evaluations, over the course of the first 6 years of delivery, what we realised is we've now got a really solid theory of change. So we know what the inputs and what the incremental outcomes are, because now we've got a building evidence base. And because of what we've done, we were trying to look for an RCT grant, so randomised control trial, which means you give one group of families family by family and another group you don't, and you control that. And you do that in a way that is appropriate and doesn't create any harm, et cetera. What we realised is actually that costs millions to do it well, and we didn't want to do something that wasn't done well. So we're working with Better Start, which is a part of the Adelaide University. They're epidemiologists looking at children's outcomes and better understanding what needs to happen in the system to ensure children grow and thrive in South Australia. They've got a whole heap of data. We've also got family data that we're allowed to share. So we're doing a data linkage project, which is quasi-experimental. We don't know if it's going to work, but what we do know is that if it does work, it could give us a really good kind of developmental pathway to an affordable RCT equivalent. Because what we're doing is we've got data from families who've been in family by family. That group are then going to codify what those families look like. They're going to find a similar family group and say, well, they're the control. They didn't get it. and actually what are the differences in the outcomes of those two groups. And that will help, hopefully, help us understand what's working and what's not.
What sort of outcomes will you be able to look at through that process?
We're looking at data from AECD, hospital admissions, police, child protection. Basically, they're collecting a whole heap. What we can't get access to is welfare because that's federal. What this might do is help us build a case to then go to the federal level and better understand from a data point what employability looks like for these families, both for parents and children. So we're looking at the dual generations.
So with all this evidence, I mean, people must be flocking to get the program.
People are really interested in the program, yes. I think the next evidence, the next evaluation will help us possibly seal the deal a little bit more. And it's interesting, evidence alone is not going to get you across the line. We know that. You know that yourself, Chris. It's basically about visionary leaders who feel like they can support a new way of doing something, because this is very different. We know that from supporting staff, both our own staff and staff of our partner organisations who come from, you know, child protection or community services. Practice is different. Systems, organisations are designed in a particular way that make it very difficult to practice in a mirroring way. So we mirror practice across the whole pipeline of support. So the system isn't ready to accept this other kind of thing. So whilst there's lots of ideas and I think we've got people's heads and hearts, we don't have their hands yet for full action. So we're working towards that, and hopefully an evidence base, the cost benefit analysis, and seeing some other pioneering implementation commissioners and delivery partners could help.
I think, you know, my impression is that you sort of speak to 2, 3, 4 organisations every year who sort of are really keen to get family by family, but it's actually very few of those follow through. It'd be really interesting to understand what's happening there.
Yeah, what we're hearing is their funding systems don't enable this kind of work, and people want, well, at the moment commissioning happens in particular silos of employment, community services, education, child protection. And actually what we know from the program is it supports all of those and it creates outcomes in all of those sectors. So no one person can see the full value, or one commissioner can see the full value and hence find the investment in it. So it's not necessarily a universal piece. It's too expensive for that. It's not necessarily child protection, because we know we don't hold that many risky families as 100%. It's 30% of the cohort. So it's trying to help the system understand how to fund it and also how to deliver it in the system. So effectively it's the price, which is the first bit that's the issue. What we've seen though with weavers, a lower price point, it's not just the price. Actually it's practice. How do you get the right system to understand it's not about the number of outputs, it's actually about outcomes. So how do you understand those outcomes and understand the value for the system? And in part, that's part of what the evidence base might develop or show. If we work in this way, in 10 years' time, we can see this child has got X, Y, and Z outcomes versus this child who didn't get any of that, and they're basically still not achieving year 12, they're not graduating, they're not, et cetera. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And it seems almost by definition, because this fits families better, it fits the systems less well.
Doesn't fit because the system isn't designed for families. Exactly. Yep.
I think what's really interesting in this journey has been how, yeah, of course, there's the innovation, the kind of the model, but that's only really one part of it. There's all of the mindsets and sort of back end things and attitudes to risk and funding that need to be changed in order to create the enabling conditions for this kind of innovation, which was always designed to be something different. It wasn't designed to fit in. But now you're really feeling that as we're trying to wedge it in.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you. It's just keeps
going. We're having some successes, right? Let's talk about the UK and let's talk about how that came about and sort of what we've learned about creating the conditions for another organization, that's quite, the other side
In a different time zone.
To take on the model.
And a different context. So we're in the middle of COVID right now, obviously, global pandemic. The UK has been hit quite hard. They haven't been able to get out and about, and we couldn't necessarily deliver. Our first kind of idea of how we'd scale internationally was actually have some of the team go overseas. We couldn't do that. So what we've now done is create an online learning platform that speaks to all the different elements of family by family, what the key points are, what the different learning tools are, what the different interaction tools are. And we've actually undertaken scoping via distance. So what we do when we go to a new location is we basically better understand what's going on in that context, scope what the experience is for families, practitioners, commissioners, bring that back and then go, well, what do we need to adapt to make sure the model has the best chance of fitting into that context? Then we adapt those things and the actual frontline staff start delivering. So basically recruit, et cetera. So it starts out with really intensive coaching. So we've spent lots of time working nights predominantly, and the team over there have worked mornings. They deliver the learning where they can. We've adapted things, recruitment strategies, etc., for being and living in a lockdown. So how do we get access to families when they can't leave the house, when their kids aren't going to school? Really try to shift how that works in that system to make sure it's still reaching the right kind of families. And some of those innovations are around using social marketing and social platforms, so Facebook. Not necessarily Twitter. Twitter isn't that great. Instagram. How do we actually engage where families are at and using that terminology in a different way? So there's the online learning platform, lots of online experiences. We've actually, the next piece is bringing in some of the families here in South Australia to actually do a proxy coaching session with sharing families so that the frontline coaches can start to train themselves on families with families who've been there and done that. So what we're trying to do in the delivery of a learning platform and basically a capability building platform is actually continue to model that lived experience. So actually we could tell you lots of stuff, but hear it from a family first, because this is going to give you the best chance of understanding what it might feel like to practice in context. What we've also done is had to better understand how do we support the quality mechanisms via distance. So we can't, we don't have the same relationships and the ability to then go to the north here in South Australia and go, hey, how are families going, and have that conversation. It's via distance, right? So how do we, what is the kind of the back-end systems to make sure we know the model's being delivered with fidelity? So we've got the online learning platform. We also have a practice platform that helps coaches actually deliver the program with fidelity. So it's online, it's automated. You can't progress if you haven't done certain things. So you need to have a goal, et cetera. You need to answer particular questions at every coaching. That then gives us and also the team in the UK an overview of what's happened in the week and an ability to review if things are going in the right way. We also then collect lots of information there about families and families' experiences, which help us understand that the model's being used and the right families are coming through. We also then have a dashboard that gives us an overview of where we're at. And then what sits outside of that is then the coaching around all those different components of work when things are going really well and also when things aren't going well. And what we're trying to work through now, which is a future thing, is when we're at startup, we've got something also called the Big Book that comes to life through those different platforms, which is like a manual. How often do we test with families and practitioners if those are being delivered with fidelity, with the view that actually families, in the first case here in Australia, will be doing those quality checks in the UK, and then we'd be doing the same thing for SA.
And that Big Book, I mean, that was something that you, I and Danny worked together on to really try and distill quite recently, really. But what are the kind of core principles and the key interactions behind family by family? That's after years of running it, we have pretty good sort of implicit understanding of it, but it sort of need to be written down, right, and sort of distilled so that other folk could pick it up.
Yeah, and it was It's also to make sure we did write it down, because my kind of overview of it was actually quite limited. It was Danny and yourself that did a lot of the hard work. And really when talking with Danny is what happens if she gets hit by a bus and we don't know what's in the big book. So it's also how do we make sure we've documented it but also had the right discussions to go, is this where we really need it to be? And we've had a number of false starts in the past. So we've actually prototyped that big book a number of times, and also this quality system. So I've seen, I think, three different goes, and there were two before I started, of what should this quality framework look like, and how do we deliver it in a way that makes sense to an organisation that isn't an innovation hub, that is an organisation that delivers lots of different services. So how does it make sense? How can they best digest it and use it? Because there's no point having something that gets dust on a shelf. So really that's really why lots of the online platform, the dashboard and the data practice platform is really designed to ensure the user can engage with it, and that making sure that the learning journey for the coach and their manager can respond to different learning styles. So you've got it in writing, you've got it in a video, you have it in coaching. And I think the next generation will go, well, how do we need to do some sort of testing, or what are different ways that people need to learn and do, which is also role modelling and doing it. So that's where the families come in.
Here's Danny Madsen explaining the family by family learning platform that had to be invented to support implementation in the UK.
Thank you. So we created the learning space, the family by family learning space, which was kind of made up into six big chunks of set up, localize, engage, link and meet, coach and evaluate. And when you go into, we tried to order it into what people would be learning in the order of delivery, that basically when you go into like a section, any section, you'll get like, and it is a train the trainer kind of model, you'll get some stuff to learn. So that's like a Google slide that teaches you all about onboarding a new coach. You get a standard. So if you're doing this well, what are the features of best practice? You get a little toolkit, which is full of like readings about all the tools that you might need to do this interaction. A facilitator's guide and some stories from the real world that they can listen to. And every single one of these kind of follows the same kind of pattern. I think it was overwhelming, I will say that. I think the staff, one of the bad things about it was the staff was like, there's so much to learn and we can't deliver and learn all this. And, you know, they got wobbly around it. But the good thing is every time they get to an interaction, they can go back here and they can remind themselves. And so me and my colleague Barg have kind of systematically been doing coachings where we work our way through all the content. We've been recording those sessions and then sending those through as well. And but when a staff gets to a certain interaction or a certain point, they say, oh, what is it that I need for that? They can go back to that tools section and they can download whatever they need and have a go.
So with the quality work, so with our quality system, and because the focus is, well, the real fidelity point is with families, the next innovation around that is actually to employ sharing families or alumni sharing families to actually be trained in undertaking the quality discussions, and they would then be the feedback loop. And the intention there is it's not one of us going in with power over either the implementation partner, the practitioner, or the sharing family. It's another family. And in the system, it would equalise it. And so then that feedback and analysis will actually be done all by a family. And so what that means is we could actually then start contributing employment outcomes as we scale.
So what stage are the UK at now?
They, I think we might actually have two link-ups, if not three.
Oh, wow.
So families have been connected, goals have been set, sharing families have done their profiles, their paper profiles at the moment, and seeking families have chosen their sharing family. So that means connections. We then need to have coaching, and we also, of course, need to maintain recruitment. So how do you keep the numbers coming through and meet the system KPIs, as well as making sure it makes sense to those families? Because what we're doing is we've done an initial scope, but also with the delivery, we're also iterating delivery to make sure it makes sense in that context whilst they're delivering. So it's another layer of complexity. So there is this constant co-design process. And I omitted to say, actually, there's an evaluation in the UK as well that is action-based research. So there'll be a focus group of seeking families and sharing families, and also of the system, to better understand what's working, what's not, and actually how do we shift that. And that'll be happening in 6 or 8 week sprints, so that there's a 360 view from a family perspective, practitioner and commissioning lens. What do they need to do to make and shift this and make it work? And we'll get some of that input as well to understand what the feedback's been from families. If families are saying in particular that, you know, the referral pathway isn't working for them, or the location isn't right, or the questions aren't quite right in coaching, what do we need to adapt for that context? So yes, that's where they're at. Yeah.
And what's that's really, really exciting.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And what, I mean, when we scale the model, there are some things that we try and keep the same, because they're the things that create change for families, things like the link up between the two families and the time they spend together. But what did anything need to change to make it work in the UK context?
Yeah, one of the, of course, the look and feel of all the promotional materials. You needed families that are from that location in Stoke-on-Trent. Also the words, like the colloquialisms that don't exist here that need to exist there. As well as, you know, we know there's colloquialisms even between, you know, Salisbury and then Norlunga. There's different ways. It's the same thing in that context. So they're not fidelity points that need to shift. The one tension I think that both, that most of us are feeling is like, oh, there couldn't be that volunteer reimbursement piece because of the UK law. So we're still working through what that looks like. But we, you know, in the past where we said no categorically, they need to get X, Y, and Z, with a view to understand what the intention is of that reimbursement, we've now gone down to the even lower level or the higher level, depending which way you want to go. What does that reimbursement represent? What's the intention? Is the intention about demonstrating that lived experience is a real asset and should be valued? Then actually having a discussion and actually scoping with a number of different families, which we've come some way in doing, is, well, how could we demonstrate and give value to that experience, so you're not feeling like everything's been taken away from you, so that you're getting filled from this journey as well from a compensation perspective. So we're testing, there's a number of different things that could exist in the UK, and they're just about to start flying as the link up starts. So they, you know, we've played with different ideas of other family kind of events that you could do that would usually not be within your means. Is it about providing different experiences for your family, or is it about creating those experiences between the seeking and sharing family? So they're being tested, and what we'll check to see is if those employment outcomes or those educational outcomes that we know happen for sharing families continue or not. So there is a bit of a test to see, is that family by family, or is this family by family without a reimbursement? Does that make sense?
But so it sounds like they're still, even at this in some ways what seems like a late stage, there's still a lot of invention having to go on.
Loads. Yeah, loads.
It's been, I've been trying to think about all of the sort of peaks we've climbed on this journey over the years, and it sort of feels like there's something really important about, you know, the design of how you create change for an individual family, the sort of the link up type thing. And then the next one, I think, was something about how do you train families to do that, so that we can have not just one sharing family doing that, but many. And then the next step up about how do you train coaches, and then how do you operationalize that in a site so you can have not just one coach, but several coaches in many families. And then there's been there's a lot of innovation required about how do you kind of operationalize things at that scale, even though it's a relatively small scale, it's still a lot bigger than the prototype. And then it's been, and things like the quality process have been part of that, but also then how do you spread that to other locations? So the scoping process and the adjustments that need to be made. And then how do you spread that to other organizations or other countries, other continents, even as you're doing now?
So we're getting there with Family by Family, right? We're 10 years down the line. We've got a growing evidence base. We've got a formula and systems now for replicating it in another organization on the other side of the planet, nonetheless. But at the same time, we're starting to see and recognize that we need to think differently about what we scale. Many people are interested in what Family by Family represents, but not everybody wants the model for families or has the money to fund something as sophisticated as the Family by Family model. We've come to realize that if we only concentrated on scaling Family by Family or the other models that we've developed, for example, Weavers, which supports people in caring situations, or the Virtual Village that's supporting people who are isolated and often fleeing domestic violence, if we only did that, there'd still be an awful lot of people who want these peer-powered solutions, but couldn't get to them. We're missing out on an awful lot of opportunities to create outcomes for a much broader set of people. So alongside our models, we've been supporting organizations to create their own peer-powered models. I asked Vita about those.
Could you say something about the peer-powered innovations we've supported others to create?
Yes. The couple that we've supported just recently is working in the pediatric palliative care, where actually one is around face-to-face connection of parents who've been through that process and lost their child, and supporting parents who are just about to begin that journey. And we've seen, short-term six-month impacts of people not going to their psychologist anymore, people resting, sleeping better, feeling like they're not as stressed, feeling like they don't have to enjoy every part of their child's life, but let their child have a life while they are still alive, and they may well continue to live. So they're the first bits of learning. We've obviously supported a number of organisations to deliver Weavers, and those outcomes, we're just about to release a mapping tool of over 30 Weavers and their connections and what the change has been for them. And it's been adapted for a multicultural setting, which is actually really interesting that it still works. The other things that we've done is Sticking Together, which I wasn't part of, but it does work through how do you get a lived experience of someone who's in the workforce to support someone else who needs to get into the workforce. And that seemed to be creating lots of great outcomes for young people as well who have been underemployed.
So what next? We've just come from a theory of change session around peer power and sort of what the kind of evolving emerging taxi strategy around that. But what do you think sort of 5 years in the future? How will we be scaling Family by Family or the ideas and the practices within?
And you've got it there, Chris. Like, you already know. There's the ideas and practices and the principles of what people-powered or peer-powered responses need to look like. So having delivered Family by Family for quite some time, supported others to do that, supported others to deliver Weavers, which actually we're also in the process of designing an online learning platform too to help that scale with more cost efficiency and also create the same kind of fidelity in delivery. We know just recently we've done about two or three different projects with different parts of the system where they've said we want peer and we like these elements, but actually we can't afford this. So we've actually provided coaching via distance to help frontline practitioners do their own co-design practice with a view to get something that's peer-to-peer. And what we've seen after 6 months of delivery of two of those models is that the outcomes seem to be just as impactful as the other programs that we've actually gone through a full innovation process with. So what that means is there is a real test of, right, well, we could help you create your own at a distance. That's not necessarily the whole thing. There are definitely opportunities to talk to about the practice of and the principles that embed it. I've just recently, in the last week, I've had three different discussions with people who want to do their own. It's like, oh, I want family by family. It's like, well, you're not going to have $1 million to do family by family. If this is something you want to go do in your neighbourhood, how else can we help you? So it is about how do we create that learning and opportunity and investment back into those pioneering visionaries so that it becomes like the norm. Because we know as more people do things, the hesitancy then to do it is removed. And you can look at vaccinations. I think in Australia, more people are getting them now because, oh, everybody's doing it.
So now alongside the models, we're looking at inventing a platform of supports to enable people to take up peer power in lots of different ways. One way to think about this is that any social innovation is really a bundle of different innovations. And so now we're starting to explore the ways that family by family and the other peer-powered models can be unbundled and repackaged. So there are several different tracks down the mountain to implementation at scale. We think we can support people to adopt the principles of the practice. We think we can support people to design their own models based on the patterns already in family by family and weavers and so on. And we think we can support people to take family by family and adapt it for an entirely different cohort. For example, over the years, we've seen the potential of peer-powered solutions for people living with disabilities, for parents of all kinds, for new mothers, for young, talented football players, or even CEOs. In fact, we're kind of struggling to see an area of support that wouldn't benefit from what we're calling peer-powered solutions. We see it as a new kind of category of help, something that sits between informal community supports and formal supports, something that could catalyze new resource and create kinds of change that professionals struggle to create otherwise. How are we going to do that? We don't yet know. That's the next peak of invention that we've got to scale.
There is another thing, though, around, and you mentioned it, around the universalism of these things. Actually, what I've been toying with is how do we make sure that anybody who needs to connect to another person can do it and is an online platform the ability to do that? How do we scale it through a digital response, I think, is a really interesting piece, because that could give us both the efficacy, connection, and also a revenue stream to keep actually learning and doing this kind of innovation around the work for more of a more complex kind of support. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we've been talking about this from a sort of almost a theoretical point of view from innovation, but you've got to keep the money flowing. Absolutely. To kind of grow these things. And so it's sort of, you're simultaneously doing innovation whilst running a business to ensure that you can keep innovating and developing.
Yeah.
Let's rejoin the Sternins in Vietnam. Last time we were with them, they'd identified the positive deviant practices in their discovery stage. And indeed, they'd found a formula for villages to adopt those strategies sustainably. The formula was something like you bring the villagers together in their neighbours' homes, they practice those strategies, and they need to find the crabs and the greens as the price of entry, so they build those behaviours over time. They developed something that was successful and indeed was starting to attract a lot of interest, but they didn't yet have a formula for spreading it to multiple villages. That came next. Because the program site was within a day's drive from Hanoi, dozens of visitors came to call. Soon there were numerous requests from the UN agencies and districts and provincial health offices outside the program area for help in implementing the program in other parts of the country. Foreign delegations began to arrive, including staff from Save the Children headquarters in Connecticut, who left resolved to disseminate the idea to other regions. But, as we had been so dramatically reminded during the pilot stage, people learn best by doing. We were exposed to the grave risk of being compromised by success and struggled for a way to achieve scale, given the flood of interest in learning about the PD approach. One rainy day, a UNICEF representative paid a visit. We sat together in a sky-darkened, corrugated roof hut with a group of local mums whose kids had participated in the nutrition programme. The mums were animated, shouting to be heard above the hammering of the monsoon torrent of the roof. They explained how they had rehabilitated their children and how it was possible for any poor family to have a well-nourished child. They were absolutely intent on making sure that the foreign guest got it right. After an hour or so, we thanked the women and left the hut. Our drenched visitor stood transfixed, seemingly oblivious to the elements. "That was amazing," he said. "I've never learnt so much in so little time. It was a living university." The concept was born. The Living University was built around 14 programme villages. They provided a social laboratory for exposure to the nutrition process at different phases of implementation. Participants could learn the conceptual framework, but more importantly, participate in fieldwork in the villages and spend 12 days directly experiencing the essential components of the programme. After graduation, Living University participants returned to their provinces and districts to implement the PD nutrition programme in two new villages. They then became their own mini Living University for further programme expansion in adjacent areas. Over the next 7 years, an estimated 50,000 children were rehabilitated through the efforts of more than 400 Living University graduate teams. And so, based on another hunch, the Living University, the Sterdins and the villagers developed an effective formula for spreading it across multiple villages. Ultimately, the programme will be replicated in over 250 Vietnamese villages, creating a 65 to 80% reduction in childhood malnutrition in 22 provinces with a total population of 23 million. And they didn't stop there. Go, Sternings. They codified the whole approach and developed an algorithm, if you like. They called it positive deviance. They wrote about it. They reused it themselves, but also trained other people in using that same approach to solve a whole variety of development challenges. They climbed and climbed. Each hour got harder until they finally reached the summit. Jubilant and exhilarated, they relax a little. They felt on top of the world, but their adventure was not over. They still had to descend. Already tired and with light fading fast, this, as any experienced mountaineer knows, is the most dangerous part of the journey. I took the metaphor of innovation as mountain climbing from a book by Chris Trimble and Vijay Govindarajan. And it's called The Other Side of Innovation, and it's about everything we haven't talked about yet. It's about how you put formulas into practice, into the real world, so they actually create outcomes. The argument in the book is that everybody focuses on getting to the summit, on getting to the formula. But actually the real work comes after that. And it's not until you do that work that you actually know your formula works. Their core practical idea is that implementation will go much better if the people responsible for implementation, for putting innovations into practice, were also involved in the discovery phase and in the invention phase. And so often, that doesn't happen. They're careful to make the point that innovation is a different kind of work to business as usual work. And so you need some people on that team who are dedicated to innovation, but you also need some people who are what they call shared, people who are from the business as usual work, also working as part of that innovation team. And that's what we did with the virtual village, where the team designing that model was made up of service delivery people and families with lived experience of domestic violence and a design team.
And it's what the Sternins did when they enabled villagers to identify those effective strategies and then pass them on to their neighbours. And when we came to starting Family by Family as a service, it was Carolyn Curtis who had been through that prototyping period that led the implementation. And that made things a whole lot easier. And she'd say, that's when the work really started. So it doesn't matter if your formula is for a set of principles or a set of practices or a new service model or a new funding model or a new organization. If you involve the people who'll be responsible for implementing those in their development, there's a greater chance that your insights and hunches and formula will actually lead to outcomes. Epilogue. From discovery to implementation, to the moon and back again, with a short deviation into biscuits. This is a story about the invention of a formula for innovation and its application to the Australian Volunteers Program.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
The task of getting to the moon, and ideally back again, was profound. NASA had to produce tens, probably hundreds of thousands of effective innovations. And to do that, they needed to produce perhaps 10 times as many ideas. To avoid wasting time and resources, they needed to invent a way to identify the best ideas quickly. They didn't have to scale one innovation mountain. They had to scale a whole range all at once. To manage that, they developed what they called a phased review process. At the end of each phase, engineers had to demonstrate that their work justified further investment. In the early stages of development, when ideas were more embryonic, the burden of evidence was lighter. Innovations just had to show potential. In the latter stages, where significant dollars had been invested, scientists had to show that things really worked. Let's imagine. NASA might start with four teams working on rocket propulsion systems, knock out the least promising in the earlier phases, and focus investment on the systems that showed the most promise. In the 1980s, business would refine this phased review process to become the stage gate process. It's a process widely used in product development. And indeed, I first came across it 20 years ago or more when I worked for Britain's biggest biscuit manufacturer, designing new kinds of biscuits. And they had a really rigorous biscuit development process, and it would start in the mystery. You'd work with chefs and marketeers to develop wild ideas for new kinds of biscuits. And then you'd visualize them and prototype them, and you'd have test batches cooked by the chefs, and then they'd take them to focus groups. And there was about sort of 10 or 15 stages you had to get through to get your biscuit on the shelf. And in 5 years of working for them, I never succeeded in doing that once. But we've also adopted a version of this stage-gated process for the Australian Volunteers Program itself as the way to manage the multiple innovations that go through the Innovation Fund. In 2017, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade decided to allocate funds to innovation in volunteering. They wanted to find new ways to better meet the developmental needs of organisations and volunteers who are part of the program. And so the Australian Volunteers Program Innovation Fund was born. Anna Traher, who heads up the Innovation Fund, told me this: there's heaps of innovative practice and ideas already, but it hasn't always gone to scale or across countries. And at the same time, technology is creating new opportunities. Significantly, there are some parts of the population that find it hard to participate in volunteering, but would love to. For example, people with disabilities and professionals who can't leave their jobs and families for 2 years. Innovation in organizations often starts with a particular idea or a problem that needs to be solved. Innovation in the Volunteers program started in a very different place, with the budget to design and run an innovation fund that would create the conditions for effective innovation, all the way from idea to program integration, from mystery to algorithm. Back to space. At the height of the space program, NASA was allocated 4% of GDP and created jobs for 500,000 people. Now, the resources of the Australian Volunteers Program Innovation Fund are a bit more modest than that. They receive funding of approximately 1% of the program budget, plus a person, Anna, and now Anna's time is supplemented by an innovation coordinator, Carla, and an innovation partnership with Taxi, and a team of 16 innovation associates, 10 who are volunteers spread across 15 countries. Like NASA and product development processes around the world, a stage-gated process is the central infrastructure for innovation in the program. And it's designed to make sure that worthy innovations get resources, to weed out the weak ideas early on, even if they happen to be the pet idea of the innovation fund manager. Anna told me, "I think I've had my best ideas killed, and rightly so. I think all of us have at some point, but that means it's working." So the stage gate process, the innovation pathway in the fund, is still a bit of a work in progress. Whilst commercial stage gate processes have to consider a three-way fit between consumers and products and the company, that's sort of how it worked when I worked in Biscuitland. But innovations in the Australian Volunteers Program have to consider a four-way fit between the needs of the partner organisations, volunteers, the program, and government diplomacy. I interviewed Dr. Elizabeth St. George, who's one of the members of the IPG, the Innovation Pathway Group. They're the folks who make decisions about what proceeds through the pathway and what doesn't. She said that this is an emerging approach in the public sector and it's being talked about, but it's not very well understood at this point. In the private sector, there have been processes around selecting and developing ideas for some time, but in the public sector, something like this is very new. Now, there's some precedent of using a stage gate process in the public sector for digital development, but this might be one of those rare non-digital applications. I think it's really interesting that given a stage gate process wraps some healthy bureaucracy around innovation, around that journey from mystery to heuristic to algorithm, you might expect it to be more popular in government than it is. I think Anna's got a really interesting take of all of this, and she trained as a lawyer, so she's got this interesting perspective and describes the stage gate process as looking for a burden of proof. At the outset, we're looking for a believable balance of evidence, just in the same way that a legal system and courts look for evidence. To date, around 30 early stage ideas, or as they're officially called, hunches, have been put forward to the pathway, and only three have got through the first gate. For example, a proposal to do more for young people was stopped after an initial investigation showed that young people were already overrepresented in the program. The most progressed opportunity at this stage is open volunteering, which is a mixed mode volunteering that combines 2 weeks in country with 4 months of follow-up online volunteering. Emma Hess, who's the manager of partnerships and innovation, said it creates potential for so many more Australians to take part in the program, as well as giving our partners access to a much wider range of skills and experience. Another stream of work we're exploring at the moment is if there might be something new out there in volunteering. We're taking a speculative futures approach and exploring what volunteering might be in 2050.